This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 13th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. It's going to be me, David Pleasant, bringing you the programme today. In this episode of the show, we'll speak to internationally renowned architect Daniel Libeskind as he reflects on the art of building for memory.
Memory is a living space. It's a living light that can really create a sense both of the irreversibility of the past, but also of the beauty of the future.
After that, we'll stay in New York and discuss proposals, which have now been approved, to transform JFK's iconic TWA terminal into a huge new hotel.
They really want to redo it in the spirit of the early 1960s, in, you know, what's been described as Austin Powers style.
Plus, we'll hear from French fashion label APC's creator and creative director, Jean Tuitu, and then to Singapore to visit the team behind design studio, the Ministry of Design. All that to come and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, to start the show, we turn our attention to New York and hear from one of the most famous names in that very select group of living architects that can be called Starkitects. Daniel Libeskind is the Polish-American architect behind the development of Ground Zero, the former site of the Twin Towers in New York. His previous commissions include the Jewish Museum Berlin, and he has plans for Holocaust memorials in both Ottawa and Amsterdam. In the current October issue of Monocle magazine, we investigate the right and wrong ways to design for memory. So, last month, I spoke to Daniel about his career in this very sensitive and specialised of design fields, and began by focusing on that incredibly complex New York commission.
To many people in the world, memory seems to be an afterthought, or maybe even a footnote. But if one really thinks about memory, it is the driving element of our orientation. Without memory, we would have absolutely no idea who we were, where we have come from, where we are going. So to me, memory is really the light of architecture. It's the ground on which a building is built. And even a building which does not carry the weight of a major memorial or major historical site, still, to be a good building, has to partake of the memory of the site. And the memory is extending, you know, into invisible realms, into realms that are sometimes inaudible in terms of that history. But always, if you tap into it, you can create something that resonates not only in the present, but into the future. So every time I'm confronted with a project that deals with a memory, whether it's a, like here in New York, Ground Zero, the entire site, I really conceived as a site that has to do with a memory that will create a new future for that site without ever forgetting what happened. And I think that's part of the constructive idea of memory, that memory is not about nostalgia, it's not about sentimentality, it's not about some metaphors that are thrown into a kind of code, but memory is a living space, it's a living light that can really create a sense both of the irreversibility of the past, but also of the beauty of the future.
If we talk about that, maybe that tone, or you know, how exactly you express that memory, in your opinion, how do you strike that balance between the somber act of memorialising, of taking into account the tragedy that was, and also a sort of form of optimism and the kind of optimistic side of what is an important site, both in terms of topography and infrastructure? You know, how do you balance that?
Well, that's a very complex question, but what I want to say is that my aim, for example, here in New York at Ground Zero, was the affirmation of life. After these terrible events, which destroyed and murdered and killed so many people, how do you do that? You have to, first of all, concentrate on public space, not only on the aesthetic of individual buildings, which are, of course, important in themselves, but are really secondary to how you dispose of that public space. How do you create a sense of coming together of people? So, out of the 16-acre site here in New York, I did something which really no other architect proposed. I decided that at least half of it, which is almost 8 acres, should not be a site for buildings, especially the site at the very center where the buildings, all the buildings stood, should be made into a memorial. And not only a memorial on the ground level, which is just on the street level, but a memorial that really goes deep, some 75 feet down to the bedrock itself. So that's really kind of a strategy, that memory is not just a few signs here and there, a sculpture here and there, and a kind of mental note, but that the space itself, the three-dimensional space of a city, encompasses that memory. And what is future-oriented about a site is that when you experience this public space with its footprints, with the waterfalls, which was also an idea I had from the very beginning, the acoustical and the natural sense of life to be added, the buildings, the many high-rise buildings, four skyscrapers, some of the tallest in America, are standing not in the center, but really on the periphery, which echo also the Torch of Liberty, so that they will not throw shadows onto this grand public space. So my basic idea was not to create standalone buildings or standalone memories, but to create a new neighborhood, a sense which weaves together the past, the tragedy, the memory, which includes, of course, the museum, which goes all the way down to bedrock, where the slurry wall organizes the entire museum space. And it's very visceral when you go down there. It's not just, you know, a museum space. It's really the physical artifacts of that destructive day. But then as you ascend back to the city, you have a completely new sense of life and the beauty and the really fantastic energy and optimism of this beautiful city of New York.
Well, fantastic positivity, wonderful kind of description there. But could we just highlight some of the opposition that maybe you came across? You know, there must have been countless to-ings and fro-ings. I mean, it was a laborious process that everyone knows something of the timescale. But maybe tell us some of the stumbling points, some of the design problems that you had to overcome.
Oh, my God. It's a story that could make a Hollywood film. I mean, this is New York City. We have many stakeholders. We have the families of the victims, which are in the thousands and thousands of people. It's brothers, it's sisters, it's uncles, it's kids, it's parents. They're all involved in the thousands and the thousands of people. We've got the Port Authority of New York, one of the mega organizations that has, you know, 7,000 architects and engineers controlled by the governor of New York, very powerful, and governor of New Jersey, another powerful governor. We've got the streets of New York controlled by the mayor of New York. We've got the PATH train authorities that are independent. We've got the, you know, MTA, the subway authorities. We've got New Yorkers, just people in New York. So, of course, it's easy to talk about it, but to achieve it, you have to really bring together a consensus. You have to be able to navigate through a very complex process. And of course, there's going to be opposition. In the beginning, you know, there were many different ideas. I mean, the developers wanted the big towers as close as possible to Wall Street. They didn't want the tallest tower to be next to the Hudson River. They wanted completely different ideas. They wanted buildings in the center of the site. They wanted a, you know, a memorial to be very small and not to go underground and so on. Look, this is New York. You're going to have 20 million different opinions. But if you have an idea, if you are, as I am, a believer in democracy, that it's not good to just from the top down scream, but you have to engage every stakeholders and create a consensus so that people agree this is good for us, this is good for all of us. Even though initially people started with very different and often diametrically opposed ideas as to what to do on the site. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. It takes a long time. You have to be able to take some punches. You have to be able to wipe your bloody nose and go on. And it's tough, but it's also so incredible. How amazing to be involved in this project with so many thousands of people who are really part of it, and to create something that is not just for today, but for the future of this city and for this country. And it's also about memory globally, because this is an event that changed the world. And to me, that is the function of architecture, to create a future which is open, which is full of life, which says something symbolic. You know, the tallest tower is 1776 feet high. That's the date of the Declaration of Independence, the first document of human rights. And look, I thought, in the sky, no building will ever surpass that idea. You can build buildings that are three times as high somewhere, you know, in the world, but no one will ever surpass that number in terms of what it says about human beings and human rights and democracy. Since I started working, 100,000 people have moved to Lower Manhattan. Now, that's the biggest proof of what the site is about. No, it was a vacuum. There was a void. There was a sadness. And today, it's probably the most energetic part of New York State, certainly of New York City. It's a renaissance of New York, and I think it's something so incredibly exciting that we are seeing now a new Hudson River, a new East River, a new Lower Manhattan, a new connection to Chinatown, to Battery Park, to Tribeca. It's a renaissance of New York.
That was me speaking to Daniel Libeskind, lead architect behind the Ground Zero Memorial and Development in New York last month. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, we keep our attention in New York and look this time to the city's JFK Airport. Plans to redevelop what must be one of the world's most iconic airport buildings took off in September as it was announced that the 1962 TWA terminal would be revived as a hotel. The announcement came from Governor Andrew Cuomo that owners, the New York and New Jersey Port Authority, have given the all clear on plans for the 53-year-old structure, which has stood redundant since the demise of TWA in 2001. The building, which is famed for its sweepingly sculptural form and for being one of the first airport facilities to boast enclosed jetways and baggage carousels, will, by 2018, be reborn as a 503-room TWA Flight Centre hotel. To find out more and to discuss the importance of this New York landmark, our New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, spoke to Kerry Jacobs, contributing editor of Architecture magazine.
This is a final boarding call for the Aer Lingus, flight EI301 to Margaret.
The thing you need to know about the TWA terminal at JFK is that it's the last vestige of an earlier version of the airport, one that no longer exists for the most part. So it was designed by Eero Saarinen. He designed it in the late 1950s. It was completed in 1962. So all these buildings were designed really at the dawn of the jet age. And the way to think of it is they were all designed like buildings for a world's fair. You know, each airline had its representative architecture and kind of its vision of the future in architectural form. And so this was one of those buildings. And Saarinen designed this thing that looks, I don't know, kind of like two cherry stone clams back to back. It's very curvy. The interior of the main space has a vaulted ceiling. It's not really that tall. It's about five stories tall, but it's all this sort of luscious curvilinear space, no right angles, no angles at all. And then there are two wings, two low-lying wings, one that was for ticketing and the other was for the baggage claim. And if you think about, say, a contemporary building by Calatrava, that's what it looks like. Except that, you know, if Calatrava designs something or Frank Gehry designs something that's, you know, strangely shaped, they then have computer software that figures out how to engineer it and how to construct it. And this was just all kind of improvisation. And it proved to be, you know, splendidly symbolic and hugely impractical.
And now this latest incarnation.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, there was, I guess, a request for proposal, and the winner was this hotel. It's not even a hotel chain. It's a company called MCR that owns a lot of hotels. Most of what they own is, you know, your garden variety, suburban Marriotts and Ramadas and those kinds of things. So on the surface of it, it's a little worrisome. On the other hand, their one historic adaptive reuse in Manhattan is an old theological seminary near the High Line called the High Line Hotel, which they redid as a pretty nice.
Yeah, that's great.
So that gives them, you know, it's something they're thinking about. And they're working in partnership with JetBlue. I mean, the plan is to have a pretty large hotel, like 500 rooms and a conference center, but all of the hotel rooms would be in these newly constructed wings that are kind of these kind of rectilinear bookends.
Because the actual main hub is obviously protected, isn't it? So there's a limit to what you can change
there. Yeah, no, the building is landmarked, and I think that they really want to redo it. in the spirit of the early 1960s. You know, there were some fairly famous restaurants and lounges in, you know, what's been described as Austin Powers style, but they, you know, with orange upholstery and that kind of thing. And there was, you know, tile that isn't manufactured anymore that apparently they're going to somehow replace. And I think that they're going to do that main space very much in the spirit of the original. And I think the great thing about it is that people, you know, using JetBlue Terminal or really doing anything at JFK will have access to that main space.
But what are your thoughts about, you know, airport hotels? They are generally, in a sense, fairly limited. You know, this is an amazing opportunity to develop or extend, I guess, this listed, this protected building. But it's also taking place at an airport. You're only going to attract a certain clientele. It's not like people are going to suddenly make JFK a destination to go and stay in this hotel. Or do you think they will
might. Do? I mean, airport hotels are changing. The purpose of airport hotels is changing. And there are some really great airport hotels in the world. You know, there's a, you know, like a really nice Hilton at Frankfurt or Changi in Singapore has a, you know, a great Crowne Plaza, places that are every bit as nice as hotels that are not at airports. And there are companies that fly people in from all over the place to confer about one thing or another. And it's sometimes easy to just fly people into the airport, have their conference, and send them away without them ever going into whatever city it is. So it may be one of those places. And it may be also that people might actually enjoy staying there. I mean, airports are kind of weird and interesting. I think that there's been an effort in recent years to bring some pleasure back to them.
Your attention, please. This is the final call for LTU
Flight. That was Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, speaking to Carrie Jacobs, contributing editor at Architecture Magazine, on the future of JFK's TWA terminal. Coming up on the show, we hear from influential, if not controversial, creative director Jean Tuitu, founder of the APC brand. Plus, we go to Singapore to take a tour of cutting-edge practice, Ministry of Design. All that still to come on Section D with me, David Pleasant.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, the world's fashion weeks are over, and it's time to take stock of some of the trends and influential personalities that Monocle caught up with at Prêt Catwalk. In Paris, in late September, Monocle's fashion director, Daphné Hezard, met the French-Tunisian creator and creative director of fashion house APC, Jean Tuitu, at their headquarters on the Rue Madame. The highlight of the collection he showed was the launch of the APC times Jean Tuitu evening dress capsule range, which pays tribute to Jean's Tunisian mother, as well as Marcel Proust.
It's me collaborating with myself, in the sense of APC is some sort of superego for me. Superego meaning a man have a superego that you cannot do everything you want always. Call it a collaboration between my ego and my superego, meaning I've given order to APC to set me free and use eventually expensive fabric I wanted and do whatever thing I'm not supposed to do, like evening dresses.
Because do you feel your team is taking too much power, too much decision?
I give my team power, so I'm very comfortable with the idea. It's me. But I don't want to be too realistic sometimes. I just want to do what I want to do. So I said to them, even if it's going to cost a lot, I just want to do those dresses. I had this vision for dresses after a dream I did some time ago about somebody threading me with an arrow in the night. And I had this vision of women dressed like this, and I just did it.
And there is a clander to your mother with this dress I've had.
A few, yes, because she might be the person in my dream who might have wanted to kill me. I'm not sure. But I've seen pictures of her in the theater of Tunis. As a dancer, she was wearing something like very Diane, you know, the god of hunting. And in that dream, there's somebody dressed like this. So is it my mother who wants to kill me? I'm sure not, but maybe it's in my dream. And then my mother always called me an idiot for 40 years because I would refuse to read Marcel Proust. And I started 5 years ago. It is, yes, an homage to my mother because every dress has a name of a character of La Recherche, Temps Perdu.
Like, can you name some of the dress?
Yes, there's Albertine, Gilberte, Odette, but I will only be more precise about it. Only for, it would like a whole day conversation to document everything, and because I don't want to say superficial things about this.
You did the chance to Vanessa Siwa to make a collaboration with you, and now you're doing also some dresses like her.
Yes, actually, she helped me on a few dresses because you have to know her office is here,
My
office is there. So sometime I walk by and I see her on the fitting and I say to her, what's happening? And I say, oh, I don't know what proportion of a pocket. And then I choose for her. And for my dresses, I say to her, I'm going to do a few dresses. Would you like to do some with me? And she did some of it.
Okay.
This one is an Odette dress, which is the name of my mother and the name of a character, Proust, too.
That was Monocle fashion director Daphne Hezard speaking to Jean Twitou, creator and creative director of Parisian brand APC. This is Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, to end the show, we go to Southeast Asia. Think Singapore, and do you think of good design? There may be striking monumental projects like the Marina Bay Sands, but in Singapore, the skyline is often more about the efficient use of every air-conditioned square metre rather than any effort to link up the past, present and future. Not so, argue the husband and wife team behind one of the city's most vibrant design studios. For them, cutting-edge architecture need not forget about Singapore's roots. For Monocle, Nicholas Walton paid a visit to the Ministry of Design to find out more.
Hi, Auntie.
Hello.
Hello. Ni hao. Auntie here has been selling it for like over 50 years, since 1965. So she's as old as,
Singapore
is.
As old as independent
Yeah,
Singapore.
That's right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Downtown Singapore, a place where finance houses meet shop houses, and street food vendors like this old woman selling her wonton mee have been doing business for years. It's also home to one of the city-state's most successful design houses, which takes inspiration from the streets around it.
Yeah, we do have our skyscrapers, but we've got everything in between that and your traditional shop house. We've now turned skyscrapers into vertical gardens. You know, you can look across the street and you see a sliver
of
the
hotel over Hong Lim there. Park.
Yeah, over Hong Lim Park. There's a wonderful example of vertical gardens. We have got parks in the sky.
This is Colin Sear, the director of the Ministry of Design. He's an architect, but the ministry's projects encompass far more than just bricks and mortar. And Colin is always looking to take an unconventional approach, such as with one of their early commissions, a hotel in a heritage district of Singapore.
The only way people were approaching heritage buildings was to preserve it and to bring it back to the status it was 100 years ago, pristine and kind of sanitized all. We were very interested in trying to capture the layers of almost decay or evolution. So if you go into the New Majestic Hotel, on the ceiling, notably, you'll find layers of peeling paint. And it's kind of decrepit looking, a little bit tired, but it's authentic history of the 80 years or so of history, the three different owners painting their layers of.
But Colin's work at the New Majestic Hotel was about the new as well as the old.
So when you sit in the bath, it's in a solid bathtub. But when you stand up, your knees and above, you're framed by clear glass on either side.
The idea came from Keong Siak, that part of Chinatown, really being a red light district. And the way that men went in to choose their women was to look through a fish tank and pretend to be looking at fish while they're actually picking women, right?
Yeah. So, and Joy keeps asking me, how do you know that? So I said, research, just research.
Yeah.
observation and research.
That other voice you heard was Colin's wife, Joy. She's the business brain that balances Colin's creative juices at the Ministry of Design. That's one of the things that makes this place feel unique.
I handle the business side of things, so my job is to do everything the architects don't want to do.
Like the whipcracker.
Chase clients for money and, you know, manage timelines, HR, yeah. PR.
It's a room that's all black and carpeted and fabric walled, so it's kind of nice. And right through the middle of it, there is a wall-to-wall solid surface white table that divides the room into two. And essentially, you have two entrances. The clients come in one, we come in the other, and it keeps us separated at arm's length, so no strangling happens. And then behind that is obviously the open office plan, where it's clacking of keyboards or conversations sometimes that happen, discussions.
The MOD studio is, of course, stylish and open plan. Lounge music plays discreetly in the background, above a busy bubble of creative chatter about projects the ministry is working on all over Asia.
So this is a site in downtown Seoul. The National Tax Building has been demolished. And what we're trying to do here is create a cultural center that would help people, locals and tourists alike, to appreciate all the layers of history that culminated to what Seoul is today.
So this actually looks as though it's an archaeological dig.
Yes.
Exactly.
That is, yeah. What we wanted to do is literally expose those different epochs through this site that digs into the ground. Each layer reveals something new, possibly a motif or a material of that time.
The Ministry of Design now has offices in Kuala Lumpur and Beijing, as well as Singapore. But neither Colin nor Joy take this current success for granted. Back when the financial crisis hit, the MOD was a small, fragile startup and might not have survived if it hadn't resorted to some surprising tactics.
Well, I'm glad you found this. I have not looked at this book for like in 6 years or 7 years, you know.
The book in question is a beautifully bound hardback limited edition of the ministry's work and ideas. When the order book dried up, they posted a copy to influential designers across the world, hoping for some work. They got one reply from a woman in Beijing.
I think there's a chemistry, she said. Mm-hmm. And then, do you remember the first commission we got was to redo the insides of her house by the Great Wall,
yeah.
The commune by the Great Wall.
So 3 months later, her chief architect called again and said, oh, we've got a project, let's test you out, see if you work out. And after we did that house, she gave us another 6 projects.
Yeah.
So that was quite lovely.
So the Ministry of Design has a hard business edge and an ability to innovate, to add to its core qualities. But where might it head in the future? Here's Chris Sear finishing this report with some final thoughts.
To question, disturb and redefine is also applied to our own daily development, to always question where are we headed next. In fact, I'm really interested in the world of the virtual right now. I think space in the virtual world needs to be really designed, and it's not just digital version of real space. It's got to be evolved space. So I think I'll like to move MOD towards things like interactive space and also virtual reality space.
That was Nicholas Walton there visiting the Ministry of Design, a design and architecture studio based in Singapore. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, David Pleasant. We'll be back at the very same time next week. If you've missed any of this week's show or for our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. The show was expertly put together by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries or questions, you can contact me, David Pleasant, at dmp@monocle.com. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.